From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Megan Taylor grew up feeling that she was living in the wrong body. In her 20s, she decided to do something about it. First, she changed her name to Miles, and she began taking testosterone and scheduled a double mastectomy, part of sex reassignment surgery. The hardest part was telling his parents. Through it all, Miles kept an audio diary. Independent producer Sarah Reynolds turned his words into this story.
It's interesting that so much can be attached to your name. I've kind of already divorced myself a little bit from Megan. It feels separate from who I am now. And I really haven't latched on to Miles yet. Some days I feel more Miles than Megan. It's kind of weird. I have no problem saying Megan Taylor. Megan Taylor. No, I need to say Miles Taylor, but I need to say it in an ownership sort of way. Hello. It's 9:10 on February 2nd. I am still at work. The only people who are here, like, are the people who are cleaning. So I'm not actually working, but I am working on the letter to my parents. I need to talk to you two about something. Months ago, I started writing you a long letter, but having edited and revised and picked and poked at it for so many months, it started to feel more like a paper for school. I have a gender identity disorder. I've had it my entire life without really being able to put a name to it, and it has become severe to debilitating the past couple of years. My body may appear and function as female, but in my head I have never felt a connection to my body. The sex of my body is female, but the gender I feel in my head is male. Hello. I'm walking home. It's really quiet. I had to make this walk yesterday as well. I went out with a friend, and on my way back, I called my parents. And, like, the first thing out of their mouth is, "You're walking alone in the dark? Is it safe? Or, you know, is it a well-lit area?" And it was just that immediate protective parent act. And the only thing going through my head is, like, I'm not necessarily going to get raped out here. I would more so get mugged and beaten because I look like a guy and I walk like a guy. I think that they, you know, maybe they just think I'm out here with a purse or something. And I'm just a sitting target, you know. I think that I'm getting a little worked up with my parents. They're weighing on my thoughts. But it's time. They need to know. There's no way to protect them, and I'm doing them a disservice by not telling them. I'm not giving them a choice. I've always known I was different, but I know now that it was only covering up what I feel I've known all along, what I've known since I was 6 years old when I began putting a sock into my pants when I was alone, or when I used to pretend to shave my face with toothpaste and a toothbrush. What I'm trying to explain here is that there has always been a disconnection with my gender and my physical body, and I have tried endlessly to figure out what was wrong, why I simply didn't feel right in my skin. For the first time in my life, though, I am starting to feel a connection to who I am. For the past few months, I have been living my life as male everywhere with the exception of my work. What that means is that all of my friends have been using male pronouns when referring to me and have been addressing me by another name. The name I have chosen is Miles.
So what day is today, Chris? What's going on?
Today is the day when Miles gonna do his parents as trans man. But it is happening today.
It needs to happen. I mean, I'm gonna have this exact same feeling if I bump it back a week.
Yeah, you are.
So
this weekend is as good as any.
I'm delivering this information to you in the form of a letter for a couple of reasons. One, I never would have been able to say all of this to you in person without completely losing any and all composure. And two, I wanted to give you a safe space in which you could react however you need to react without worry of judgment, as I realize this is not easy news to hear. However, I know this is right for me. You would not be sitting here reading this letter if that were not the case.
How about, it's really important to me that you and Daddy read this together. You're going to hear me say this again in the letter, but I really am okay. I'm doing well.
Honestly, you're overthinking it.
I know, she's going to fly through this.
She's going to fly through it because this is not the meat of the issue. She's going to see how long the letter is and she's going to be like, okay, this is really far less important.
Yeah, I know. So, that's, shut up. Decent page breaks.
It's beautifully paragraphed.
I wanted to, because I'm used to, whenever you...
Just send it! I can't take it anymore.
Here goes.
I love you.
Yeah.
Do you need a hug?
I'm glad to have it done.
Mm-hmm. She'll do what she needs to do, and I think that...
She's a mother. She's gonna eat the burnt piece of toast. She's gonna look out for me.
But that's what makes her feel good at the same time, Miles. Like, you can't deny that. You know? She wants to look out for you. It's, you know, part of what she lives for.
I just checked my email, because I haven't heard from my mother. The email started with M.
M?
M. It said M.
Oh.
Dash. And she never does that. She always says, darling daughter, or Megan.
Right.
It says, no matter what you do, it will not affect your relationship with us. Those are Daddy's exact words. He is, however, still digesting. I'm not as surprised as you might think, but I dread the further anguish you will endure. Health risks are a big concern. There are lots, in capitals, lots of questions. Bottom line, we will always love you. Do hope you already knew that. Love you, infinity. M, which is that's my mom's sign-off. I'm about 3 months away from surgery. I don't think that I'm going to change my mind. The worst that would happen after 4 months is my voice would lower, and I'd be very... husky lesbian with no boobs. I wonder if my voice has changed a little, but I really don't know. It's March 24th, and this is my voice 20 days on testosterone.
This is my voice 22 days on testosterone.
Today is April 1st. And
today is April 9th.
This is my voice.
And this
28
is my
days
voice.
On testosterone.
So 5 weeks, so that's going to be
35,
37.
Today is April 23rd, 50 days on testosterone.
Today is May 5th. This is my voice.
Today is May 11th, and this is my voice. 68 days on
today
testosterone.
Is May 18th, and this is my voice. 75 days on testosterone. I just got to work, and I just kind of wanted to document this moment, because this is the last time that I am going to be at work as Megan. This is my last official Megan day. This is the last day I'm going to be using the women's restroom. This is the last time that I will have my email say Megan Taylor. I think that I've been split between these two identities since, like, August. So, that's 9 months. It's a long time. All right, over and out.
I went into surgery at around 9, out by 11, and the doctor came out and talked to Sharon and Chris. He said that everything went great.
Last year sucked. I felt like I was, you know, carrying around this secret my parents didn't know, and you want to just kind of, like, scream at them, like, I have this news. You know, something's changing, but now they know. They're really trying, and it's always a big to-do when I return to Texas for the holidays, just because I don't see them all the time.
We've had this tumultuous year of all the emotions and the, as you said, the mourning and the, you know, and then to finally get you here. And by this time, you know, now we've been waiting and waiting and waiting to see you and meet, you know, say, oh, here's Miles. But anyway, and there you were. And it was just like, oh, shoulders are bigger.
Yeah.
The hug.
Yeah, that's what it does.
But, You appear to me to be happy in your own skin.
But you said that you lost a daughter. Because I'm still here and I'm still alive. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I died.
The hardest thing was a loss.
I mean, you...
And it's, you know, the, and the sad thing, I mean, here you are, flesh and blood, warm, wonderful, lovable, our child.
Do you still feel like that?
No. No, I don't anymore, but I mean...
Initially.
I felt like the child that I knew...
Was forever gone.
The child that's in the picture on the icebox that I knew and grew up with was gone. Just pure and simple, was gone.
I just felt like somebody had taken a cannonball and shot it right through my middle, and that I was walking around living my life and going to work and doing everything and acting normal, except that I had this huge hole. It was just there all the time. It was there when I got up in the morning. It was there when I went to bed at night. It was just there. But the other thing, and I know it's the maternal guilt thing. I don't know if Daddy has these same things, but I feel you have done like this heroic feat. You've accomplished this on your own. Without, I mean, even though you've always known that you have our total love and support, but that's all you had from us. We weren't actually holding your hand. Mm-hmm. And I still have the text messages I got when you got out of surgery.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Anyway, well, I mean, we love you. Yeah. Always have, always will. It's really nice to spend time with you.
Very nice to be here.
You know how, like, when a movie comes to the conclusion and it culminates with someone, like, standing outside, and, you know, and it's just kind of like that sigh, that, you know, that breath of just, oh. I ran around without a shirt on for the first time outside. We had the reprieve from the cold weather, and it got a little warmer, and it was drizzly, and I went to the park, shed my layers, and... You know, cool breeze on my chest, and it was absolutely amazing. All right. My name is Miles, and I am 29 years old. So this is me signing off, and this is my voice, 260 days on testosterone.
That story was originally produced by Sarah Reynolds with support from the public radio website, transom.org, and Jay Allison. Miles Taylor lives in Boston with his friend Chris Jacobs. He started recording his diary in November 2008. His parents, Vicky and Bill, still live in Texas. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. When Jews attend services this week for Rosh Hashanah, they may hear melodies composed by cantor Yosef Rosenblatt. He's the latest subject in our series, 50 Great Voices. Yosel Rosenblatt, as he was known, was born in Ukraine in 1882. He became a superstar tenor in the U.S. in the early 1900s. NPR's Ina Jaffe has this profile.
You've probably never heard of Yosel Rosenblatt, unless you're a serious fan of cantorial music, in which case he is Elvis, Sinatra, Pavarotti, a singer to be remembered forever.
People felt that he was authentic, that what he sang was real.
Cantor Bernard Beer is the director of the Bell School of Jewish Music at Yeshiva University in New York.
He was an Orthodox Jew. He meant what he was doing. His prayers came from the heart.
Then there's that voice, a range of around 3 octaves that he could navigate with ease, including a famous falsetto. Rosenblatt was born to the cantor's life in a small Ukrainian town in a house with a dirt floor. The stories of him making beautiful musical sounds while still in the cradle are impossible to verify. But by the time he was 8 years old, he was being paid to sing at synagogues throughout Eastern Europe. He emigrated to New York in 1912, and when Rosenblatt sang, the synagogue was jammed. Every seat, every aisle was filled. Everyone there to hear the little man with a full dark beard.
They treated, actually, these cantors like superstars. They were the superstars of their era.
Joseph Goel was, until recently, the president of the Cantors Assembly.
We have to think back at that time where, you know, so much of the immigration of Jews that came in the late 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, these were people that found their culture and their art in the synagogue. And so to them, going to hear a cantor was like maybe other people's experience of going to hear an opera or going to hear a concert.
Worshippers were drawn not only by Rosenblatt's voice, but by his compositions. He wrote most of what he sang, says Goel, and he gave listeners something more concrete to hang on to than the traditional free-form cantorial chanting.
For instance, one of the pieces he's very well known is a recording of a Tal, and he starts out with a melody. Tal, 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 ten, lirtsot, artecha. So, as opposed to just doing something very cantorial. And the congregation could really join in and could really walk out humming, if you will.
Rosenblatt's extensive recording career made him known to an audience beyond the Jewish community. Likewise, his relentless schedule of concerts that took him around the country and across Europe. But he rejected a generous offer to sing for the Chicago Opera Company. He didn't want to play a fictional character, or wear makeup, or sing on a stage with women.
It probably helped his career,
says Bernard Beer.
Here's a cantor who feels that opera is not compatible with his calling as a cantor. Because of that, his engagements doubled and tripled. They wanted to hear and see this cantor who turned down in 1918, what was $1,000 a night to sing?
A few years later, Rosenblatt turned down $100,000 to play a part in the first talking picture, The Jazz Singer, for the same reason that led him to say no to the opera. Still, Warner Brothers just had to have him, so they threw in a scene where Rosenblatt plays himself in concert. This rendition of Kaddish Yortzeit Licht sounds convincingly scratchy to be from the first talkie, but now you can hear Rosenblatt sing it with clarity. That's from a collection of digitally restored Rosenblatt recordings produced by Mendel Werdiger, who runs a Jewish music store in Brooklyn.
I hope that the people that listen to it now will have the same pleasure of listening to his voice like when he was alive.
So far, Werdiger's produced 3 CDs of digitally cleaned up Rosenblatt recordings.
And there are literally tens of thousands of fans throughout the world that he has now that never knew him. They never had anything to do with him, but they still adore his music.
Having legions of fans during his lifetime was not enough to save Rosenblatt from his own folly. He made a disastrous investment in a Jewish newspaper that left him a ruined man. Then the Depression hit. His synagogue let him go. Concert bookings became scarce. Finally, he traveled to Palestine to sing in a documentary about the Holy Land. There, at the age of 51, Rosenblatt died of a heart attack. He's buried in Jerusalem. While Rosenblatt's still revered, his elaborate compositions are not sung in synagogues now as often as they used to be. But something of his style is heard today, no matter what composition a cantor is singing. It's that little sobbing sound. If Rosenblatt didn't invent it, he certainly popularized it. And Joseph Goel says the source of that sound was very deep.
It's a dialogue that Rosenblatt was having with God, you know, and it was a questioning, and it was a struggle in the sense of whatever he was struggling with within his life. And many of the prayers emote that kind of a feeling, you know, a questioning feeling.
Rosenblatt once said that he prayed not as a cantor, but as just another member of the congregation. I pray, he said, and listen to the prayer. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
Ina mentioned Yosela Rosenblatt's appearance in the movie The Jazz Singer. You can watch that scene at npr.org. This is NPR. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Evolution depends on new genes showing up from time to time. They stick around if they help a species survive, while harmful genes are eliminated. That is natural selection. But natural selection takes millions or even hundreds of millions of years. Humans have only been around for tens of thousands of years, and we've changed the world so much that genetic evolution can't keep up. In the final part of our series, The Human Edge, NPR's Joe Palca explores the role genes are playing in the future of our species.
There's nothing particularly unnatural about the H2 Oasis water park.
We've got a wave pool, a lazy river, two body slides, one is enclosed and the other is an open flume right over here.
What makes H2 Oasis a bit unusual is that it's in Anchorage, Alaska. Dennis Prendeville is a co-owner.
I've seen it 15 below zero out here and the place packed.
Of course, it's a big expense to heat all this water and the cavernous hall that houses the water park.
It's huge. $30,000 a month is nasty.
The point here is if you want to build a water park in Alaska or a ski slope in the Arabian Desert, you can do it. Millions of years ago, the natural environment was shaping us into the species we are now. But today, we create our own environments, and that has its consequences. John Hawks is an anthropologist and geneticist at the University of Wisconsin. He says we've created a lifestyle that is sometimes at odds with the one natural selection provided us with. For example, consider what we ate when we were hunter-gatherers before we started farming.
We adapted to a diet that was much more balanced in terms of lean meat, in terms of high-fiber vegetables, and by de-accentuating those aspects of our former diets, we've created a new environment that humans aren't real well suited to.
Sometimes genetic adaptation can happen fairly quickly. Hawks says the classic example is a mutation in a gene that makes red blood cells. It's called the sickle cell mutation. It spread through Africa once malaria became a problem there.
That's a highly adaptive mutation where it occurs when there's malaria around because it's protective against malaria.
And if you inherit the mutation from just one parent, you don't get sick. You only get the malaria protection. It's only when you inherit the mutation from both parents that you get sickle cell anemia. So if you're not living in a malaria environment, Hawks says the mutation is just bad.
You don't want to have it because your offspring have a chance of having sickle cell anemia. These genes that have, you know, so they sort of give with one hand and take away with the other.
Really bad genes tend to disappear because the people who have them frequently don't live long enough to pass them on. That's what natural selection is all about. But now, in some cases, we choose to keep these bad mutations around.
So this is a little boy who was born about 24 hours ago.
Matthew Hirschfeld is a pediatrician at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage.
We're doing a newborn metabolic screen. We do two of these tests on each baby that's born here in Alaska.
Just relax and hold still. I know
it. The metabolic screen includes a genetic test for a mutation that causes a disease called PKU.
It's a devastating disease that you can completely eliminate if you pick it up early.
Right.
So that's why it's such a great test.
But eliminating the disease does not mean eliminating the mutation. Once upon a time, children born with PKU probably would never have had offspring. Now they can if they want to, and that helps keep the mutation in circulation. Modern medicine is in the business of overcoming bad mutations.
We want to have cures for things. We want to make things better.
John Hawks says, take poor eyesight, for example. Nearsightedness could have been fatal for people whose ability to survive depended on spotting dinner off in the distance. Now it doesn't matter if we inherited nearsightedness. We wear eyeglasses.
We wear contact lenses. You get LASIK surgery. I mean, we can affect eyesight in many different ways. It's not perfect, but, you know, like many instances of technological development, you know, we tinker at it and it changes and, you know, eventually we come to a point where we either like it or we keep changing.
We've turned the notion of natural selection on its head. Nature isn't the only force that picks the genes that stick around. We're doing it too. We're moving toward a time when we can routinely repair, remove, or even insert genes in people. The question is whether we can do as good a job as nature has done. Joe Palca, NPR News.
And we have now concluded our series on evolution, The Human Edge. You can find the entire series at npr.org. And now to another angle on man's efforts to control nature. Energy projects got a big boost, many billions of dollars, in last year's stimulus bill, and a major focus was renewable energy. But as it turns out, one of the largest segments of that market, wind power, will experience a sharp decline this year in its growth rate. Last year, 10,000 megawatts of wind power were brought online in the U.S. NPR's Jeff Brady says this year, that number likely will fall by more than half.
Out on the windy plains of eastern Colorado, Canadian company Enbridge recently held an event hosted by Senior Vice President Jim Schultz.
It's my great pleasure to welcome you all to our groundbreaking celebration for the 250-megawatt Cedar Point Wind Energy Project.
Wind power advocates wish more ceremonies like this were happening around the country. 2010 will mark the first time in 6 years that this industry's growth rate will actually decline. There are several reasons for this, but probably the biggest factor has to do with government incentives. The wind industry typically rises and falls with the passing and expiration of federal tax credits. Look at a graph of wind turbine installations, and there's a sawtooth pattern.
Sometimes high, then they drop off, then they're high, then they drop off.
George Sturzinger heads the Renewable Energy Policy Project in Washington. He says wind farms are expensive to build. When the credit markets dried up in 2008, so did the money for new projects. The White House and Congress threw the industry a lifeline in the stimulus package 18 months back in the form of investment tax credits. Right now, if you build a wind project, the government will essentially cut you a check for 30% of the cost. But that lifeline is running out of rope and scheduled to expire at the end of this year. Sturzinger says that deadline prompted a lot of activity last year.
Everybody moved their projects forward into 2009 to take advantage of it. Now people are looking at, you know, can you make it for sure by that deadline? If not, you stop.
And wait for the next government incentive to come along. Another factor at work here is the price of natural gas. It's relatively cheap now, so some utilities are choosing to build gas power plants rather than wind farms. In response, the wind industry says it needs a federal mandate, a law that would tell those utilities they have to buy more renewable forms of energy. Denise Bode is CEO of the American Wind Energy Association.
We're kind of stuck without without that long-term policy in place that sends the signal to the utilities that they need to purchase wind as part of a diversified portfolio and not just depend on traditional fossil fuels for 70% of their electricity.
President Obama has said he supports a renewable energy mandate. Getting it passed this fall is one of the wind industry's priorities as lawmakers return to Capitol Hill. It's worth stressing that we're talking about a decline in growth here. That means the wind industry is still growing this year, just not as fast as last year or the year before that. Matt Rogers was appointed to oversee stimulus projects at the Department of Energy. He says despite the blip this year, the big picture looks good.
We are well on our way to doubling U.S. renewable generation capacity in the U.S., which is what the president had committed to. So we're pretty excited about the overall pace of development.
The question now is whether that pace can be maintained. Roger says it would help to have more certainty when it comes to tax policy and other incentives. That would give investors and wind energy developers the information they need to make long-term plans instead of waiting around for the next government lifeline. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It is the season when a new crop of college freshmen try to find their way around unfamiliar campuses, searching for Psych 101 or the dining hall. Going away to college requires a big adjustment for students. It's also a time of adjustment for parents, as NPR's Richard Gonzalez discovered.
We had been warned, my wife and I, that moving our firstborn son, Diego, to college could be emotionally wrenching, especially since he's leaving Oakland for the East Coast. Even so, there were emotions we weren't prepared for, like the surprise we encountered as we drove into the parking lot at Fordham University in the Bronx. The school president, Father Joseph McShane, is there to greet each family individually. He extends his hand through our open car window.
Where's Oakland?
Oakland? Oakland.
Very good. What high school?
Bishop O'Dowd.
Very good. We have one or two O'Dowds with us in the upper classes.
Father McShane is a slight, charismatic man, a Jesuit. He's wearing a white collar and black shirt, even in New York's withering heat.
Welcome to Fordham, all right? Don't lift a finger when you get to the dorm. Our kids will take care of you.
This is our second surprise, a small army of upper-class men and women wearing crimson T-shirts that say Welcome Home are there to carry the gear of every freshman into their dorm. They do this every year, and Father McShane's eyes sparkle when he says it's more than a greeting for the class of 2014.
Ah, the parents. Well, we do small things in the hope that the parents feel cared for, like refusing to allow them to lift and carry anything at the beginning of the day. And today, it's a day of both rejoicing and grieving at the same time, and because it's not just starting college. It's a change in a whole family dynamic.
Maybe that's why I'm noticing there are more than a few parents smiling through their puffy eyes.
I am Tina Capice, mother of Santina Capice.
First child leaving home.
First child of four. Lots of tears. A lot of crying. This could start now. But I won't.
In my day, going to college meant cutting the cord. But today, between texting and Skype, the cord has gone cordless, and there's no reason to be out of touch. Yet even technology can't trump the reality that her daughter's leaving the nest, says Capice.
And just try to make the best of it, because I think it's going to be hard on her as well. But she's going to have to work through it, and 18, I think she's ready. Got to let them go.
Her daughter, Santina, sounds just as convincing.
I am not really excited right now. I'm afraid. I'm nervous, but I think it will be the best decision and the best move in the end.
Some families drop their kids off and leave right away. Just ask Roseanne Pettigene, a junior history major helping freshmen get oriented. She says every family has a different way for dealing with this day.
Some parents really don't want to leave and they try to push it off as much as possible. I've seen a lot of crying. I've seen a lot of the student wants the parents to leave, so they'll just start being like, Mom, Dad, it's okay, it's okay.
My son Diego fits in this category. It's just a couple of hours before we're required to leave the campus. Time to check in with him.
So, Diego, you'll be 3,000 miles away. How often do you want to hear from me?
I have no idea yet.
Maybe I'm thinking about this more than he is.
Do you think we should set up a Skype thing so that we can see each other face to face?
Probably not.
So you don't look at it this as an ending, huh?
No, not at all. I felt like saying goodbye to my friends at home was completely blown out of proportion. There's no reason to get upset about anything.
Brave words I try to remember come the deadline for the parents to leave the campus. But first, there's a mass and a blessing from Father McShane. He says these rituals, meant to reassure the parents, are never enough.
But you're going to cry at the end of the day, I know that.
It's
going to be a long flight back to Oakland, my friend. A very long flight. And you're going to worry all the way back, did you do X, Y, Z? And your wife will say, we did X, Y, and Z, but I'm not sure we did A, B, and C.
And he's right. I do worry about my college freshman. But I try to remind myself that while Diego is my son, he's not mine to keep. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel with the story of one kid from Queens who saw his life reflected through a book of science fiction. It comes from the writer Gary Steingart for our series, My Guilty Pleasure.
I grew up as a science fiction nerd, probably the biggest one in the borough of Queens. Yearly subscription to Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine? Check. Crayon-drawn diagrams of the Battlestar Galactica? You got it. Soylent Green, Planet of the Apes, Logan's Run, I knew them by heart. But I reserved my biggest nerd passion for a John Boorman novel called Zardoz. I'm holding the gaudy saffron-colored paperback in my hands right now. God help me, I still read it to this day. What's Zardoz about? I have no idea. By any measure of logic, it makes absolutely no sense. But like every other piece of 1970s science fiction writing, it was set in a post-apocalyptic world, a future where my Hebrew school in Queens had thankfully been blown to smithereens, a world I could really fall in love with. The protagonist of Zardoz is named Zed. He's an angry dork living in a world of savage, loincloth-wearing brutals. One day, curious Zed stows away inside a floating head and gets transported to the Vortex, a Santa Monica-like paradise on Earth, whose inhabitants are called Eternals and who never die. It is they who have created his god, Zardoz. The women of the Vortex look very much like Charlotte Rampling, and they treat Zed as their pet and science experiment, humiliating him turn by turn. 100 pages later, Zed learns to fight back, in the end destroying the Eternal's paradise and replacing it with a pockmarked ruined land not unlike New Jersey. The novel, steeped in the ethos of the early 70s, seems to think that this is a happy turn of events. He was a lone mammal, adrift in their land, the novel says of Zed, which is essentially how I felt the first time I left Queens for the seductive complex land across the Queensboro Bridge. The Zed-like humiliations I suffered at the hands of Manhattan's young Charlotte Ramplings steeled me for what was required of me. Loss of innocence, the assumption of a strong, conceited personality, an endless array of pretensions. I was being groomed for Oberlin College and for the Vortex beyond it. While I cannot quote you a single sentence of Jane Austen, I am embarrassed to confess that to this day, lines like, "Stay close to me, inside my aura," and "Harvest Produce Report, submit surpluses and needs for intervortex barter and exchange," fly right past my thick nerd lips.
Gary Steingart, his latest novel is called Super Sad True Love Story.